The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 15. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Warren Benedetto, Dominic Eagle, Kyle Harrison, and Brian Martinez. Tonight, we'll hear stories of forest frights, dangerous domiciles, blustery bridges, and jeopardous jealousy. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Have you heard of that thing? You know, that thing that hides in the woods. There may be a blurry camera shot here and there, but it's definitely a thing that exists. Sure, no one's ever caught one and lived to tell the tale, but they're out there, waiting, and the fact that nobody can prove they exist is exactly what they use to get you when you least expect it. In fact, let's begin tonight's excursion by digging into the dark of the jungle, where Warren Benedetto brings us the story of two children who have made a terrible discovery and must find the way home before they discover something much, much worse. Thing is, will they do it in time? Without further ado, I present to you, no bones, just skin.
What happened to him? Manuel asked. The filthy soccer ball he'd been dribbling along the jungle floor rolled to a stop in a mud puddle on the side of the trail, suddenly forgotten. Manuel's older sister, Liliana, stood next to him, looking up at the body hanging high in the tree overhead. The carcass was little more than a shriveled husk of a man, a shrinkled bag of skin draped boneless and formless across the jungle's dense lattice of vine and branches. It was almost as if the man had been turned into a garment, as if someone had slid him down the back, extracted his skeleton, then tossed him carelessly into the tree like an old bathrobe. Without a skull to give form to his face, the dead man's eye sockets were empty chasms. His mouth hung open in a gaping, toothless scream, framed by ash-colored lips. Oily black hair dangled damp and rope-like from his flattened scalp. There was no blood on his skin, nor on the ground below. Aside from a round hole the size of a thumbnail punched through his scalp, his whole body seemed wholly undamaged on the outside. There wasn't a scratch on it. Liliana swallowed the lump that had formed in her throat. There was only one way the body could have ended up in that state. It was an abahuku, she whispered. Stop. Manuel pushed her hip playfully. Be serious. I am being serious. Manuel regarded her skeptically. You said those weren't real. I didn't think they were. The elders had cautioned Liliana about the abuhuwa, but she'd never paid much attention to their warnings. She thought the creatures were merely legends, superstitions, figments of the elders' imaginations. But when she saw the skin hanging in a tree, all of the folk tales instantly came to life. The stories were true. The elders were right. The abuhuwa were real. What do we do? Manuel whispered. Shh! Liliana listened for any signs of the abuhuku that killed the man. The air thrummed with the sounds of the rainforest, a cacophony of buzzing insects, calling frogs, and screeching birds. Droplets of water from a recent storm made flat, slapping sounds as they tumbled from the trees and dimpled the muddy ground. A holler monkey's throaty growl echoed through the treetops. Another howled in reply. Liliana's eyes scanned the canopy, looking for any movement in the sprawling branches and drooping vines. Abuhuwa were agile climbers, long-limbed and lean, able to scale virtually any surface with the help of barbed hairs that coated every inch of their live bodies. Each abuhuku had arms like a spider monkey and an insectile head with bulbous black eyes and a large proboscis, as if the gods had grafted the head of a giant mosquito onto the body of an oversized primate. They were bigger than most men, stronger too. According to legend, the creatures moved silently through the trees, sneaking into villages at night to abduct grown men and women for their meals. They immobilized their victims with a paralyzing embrace, then carried the humans' unconscious bodies high into the trees to feed upon them. There, an abuhuku would puncture the victim's skull with its proboscis, inject a liquefying venom into its body, then suck the dissolved bones, muscles, and entrails out through the skull, leaving nothing but a desiccated corpse behind. Judging by the relative freshness of the skin Manuel spotted, it appeared the man had been killed as recently as last night. The abuhuku that took him may have sated its appetite, but that didn't matter. There could be others. The only safe place was back in the village, back in their tiny ramshackle hut with a thatched roof and straw-lined door, back where their father and the other men in the village could protect them from the abuhuku. Liliana and her brother had wandered far from home, mindlessly kicking the lopsided soccer ball between them while dodging mud puddles and ducking under low-hanging vines. She wasn't sure how far they'd gone, but she was sure that they were too far to yell for help. The abuhuku would surely get to them before the villagers, if their cries were even heard in the village at all. No, there was no help coming for them. They were on their own. Liliana spoke quietly into Manuel's ear. This way. She turned Manuel back into the direction of the village. And no matter what happens, don't stop. They can't see you when you're moving. Liliana remembered the elders telling her that the abuhuwa had notoriously poor eyesight. Their large eyes let in a lot of light, which allowed them to see perfectly at night. But that night vision came at a cost. Their eyes took a long time to focus, so it was hard for them to identify moving targets. That's why they usually attacked after midnight, when their victims were deep asleep. At Liliana's urging, Manuel began padding through the jungle, picking his steps carefully to avoid any snapping branches or crunching leaves. Liliana followed close behind, cursing herself for not being more careful, for not paying more attention to their surroundings, for not heeding her elders' advice. She should have known better. The abuhuwa were not a new threat. Her people had been hunted by them for centuries. Ancient carvings on the cliffs overlooking the village depicted scenes of carnage, with hordes of abuhuwa attacking terrified villagers. In most instances, the creatures were shown seizing adults, while children were left behind, defenseless and alone. Liliana wasn't an adult yet, she was only 12, but she was close enough. If an Abuku took her, Manuel would be left alone in the wild with less than an hour until sunset. Once the sun went down, the rainforest came alive with dangers. There were jaguars and anacondas in the trees, caimans and piranha in the water, poisonous spiders and frogs in the undergrowth. Nowhere was safe, especially for a 5-year-old child. Of course, being eaten by a jaguar might be preferable compared to the alternative. It wasn't depicted in the carvings, but the stories about what happened to the children, orphaned by the Abuhua, had been handed down through the generations. After the creatures devoured the parents and left their empty skins in the trees to rot, the Abuhua returned to the village for the children. Not to eat them, but to abduct them, to adopt them, to raise them as their own. Children reared by the Abuhua grew to be bloodthirsty and murderous. They weren't physically consumed. They were drained of their humanity instead. They forgot where they came from and who they were. They found pleasure in cruelty, delight in suffering, pleasure in pain. Some even returned to their villages to aid the Abuhua in abducting other children to add to their perverse little families. In some ways, they were worse than the Abuhua because they all still looked human. They weren't, though. Despite their innocent appearance, they were monsters. Manuel looked back over his shoulder at Liliana. "I'm scared," he said, his voice trembling. Tears cut clean tracks down his dirt-streaked face. "I know," she replied softly. "Me too. But just keep moving, okay? We need to." Liliana was interrupted by a deep growl that seemed to vibrate the air around her. The hair on her arms stood on end. A rancid stench attacked her nostrils, an odor like burnt hair and spoiled meat. Manuel spun around, his eyes as wide as full moons. Liliana held her finger to her lips in the universal gesture for quiet. Manuel nodded. His chin quivered. Fresh tears streamed down his cheeks. The growl rumbled again. This time it was answered by a series of clicks that sounded like pairs of large river pebbles knocking together. The clicks seemed to ricochet off the ground and the surrounding trees, making it an impossibility for Liliana to triangulate their source. It was irrelevant, though. Wherever the Abuhuku was, it was close. Suddenly, Manuel came to an abrupt halt, stopping so quickly that Liliana nearly collided with him. "Don't stop!" "No, look!" He pointed at an enormous tree a few yards ahead of them, directly in their path. It was truly massive, so large that it would take several men linking hands to fully encircle its trunk. Its bark was like heavy and thick armor, with a soft green coating of moss clinging to its surface near the ground. As Liliana watched, the bark seemed to ripple and buckle, as if the tree was collapsing in upon itself. It wasn't bark at all. It was an Abuhuku. The creature's mottled brown hair had camouflaged itself perfectly against the tree. It only became visible once it began to move. The monster's horrifying insectile head rotated almost fully around, then tilted down as it spotted Liliana and Manuel standing frozen just below where it hung. Its eyes were like polished orbs of volcanic glass, pure black and glistening wet. Its proboscis looked like an obsidian dagger, straight and sharp, with an elongated pointed tip. A menacing rumble reverberated in its chest. "Go, go," Liliana cried. She grabbed her brother's arms and swung him around, pointing him back in the direction from which they had just come. It was the opposite direction from their village, but at that moment, it didn't matter. They just had to get away. "Run!" Liliana pushed Manuel to propel him into action. The boy stumbled, his arms pinwheeling as he tried to keep his balance. He fell to one knee, then scrambled to his feet and began to sprint. Liliana was about to follow when she was knocked to the ground by what felt like a 1,000-pound weight. The Abuhoku had dropped from the tree, landing directly on top of her. She could feel the creature's barbed hairs tearing at her skin as it wrapped its long arms around her, enveloping her in a crushing embrace. It pressed down on her, grinding her face into the soft peat of the forest floor, suffocating her. Mud filled her mouth and nose, clogging her nostrils and blocking out the rotten carrion odor of the monster's hide. Her eyelid tore against the sharp edge of a broken rock, blurring her vision with a wash of bright red blood. With her arms pinned at her sides, Liliana was unable to fight back. She tried to lift her head in an attempt to free her mouth from the mud so she could breathe. Through one half-closed eye, she saw that Manuel had stopped running. He stood motionless, glaring at the Abuhoku. "Let her go!" the boy shrieked. He picked up a fist-sized rock from the ground and threw it at the creature. The projectile bounced harmlessly off the Abuhoku's back. Undeterred, Manuel picked up two more now and threw those too. Liliana spat the dirt from her mouth as best she could. Her lungs were so constricted by the Abuhoku's crushing hold that her words were little more than a whisper.
"Run!" she gasped.
Manuel ignored her. Instead, he picked up a large branch and charged at the Abuhoku. Liliana couldn't see where the boy hit the creature, but it seemed to have little effect. The Abuhoku made a sonorous clicking sound, then tightened its grip on Liliana's body. She felt her ribs break. A bolt of searing pain caused her to scream into the dirt. And everything went black. Green and blue. Leaves and sky. That's all Liliana could see as her eyes drifted open. She stared at the foliage, momentarily amazed at how large the leaves were. She'd never seen them up close. How could she, when they were so high overhead? A series of realizations hit Liliana, one after the other. She was in a tree. She couldn't move. She couldn't breathe. Her body felt like a bag of broken glass, with shards poking out in all directions. She had no control over her arms or her legs. Her limbs hung limp and useless in their sockets. Her mouth was full of grit and slime. Her pulse throbbed in her temples. Every heartbeat felt like a foot stomping on her skull. Liliana allowed her head to roll to the side. Directly beside her, no more than 3 feet away, was the empty skin of an elderly man. Tufts of white hair encircled what was left of his head. A neat round hole was punched in the center of his scalp, near the crown. His skin was a deep brownish red with dark striations that reminded Liliana of salted meat that had been dried for storage. The holes in his face, his eyes, nose, and mouth, teemed with beetles and millipedes. As Liliana watched, a sharp-legged centipede emerged from the dead man's mouth and disappeared into a gash in his chest. The elderly man wasn't the only empty skin she could see. Parts of at least a half dozen more deflated bodies in various states of decomposition were visible around her. Some hung draped over branches like laundry hung out to dry. Others were folded into messy piles of boneless flesh. One was spread-eagled across the web of dense interlocking branches, leaves, and vines that formed the floor of the Abuhoa's nest. "A nest," she thought. "Is that where I am?" She assumed that she was. She must have been carried high into the trees by the Abuhoku that had attacked her. But it hadn't killed her yet. Why? A whimpering sound caused Liliana to turn her head in the other direction. Manuel was huddled in the nest nearby, his knees drawn to his chest, his arms hugging his shins. A heavy trickle of congealing blood ran down his face from a deep gash on his forehead. Long cuts and scratches crisscrossed his forearms, defensive wounds from the looks of them. His eyes stared at his bare feet as if he was trying to ignore his terrible surroundings by fixating all of his attention on his toes. Unlike Liliana, he didn't seem to be immobilized or seriously harmed in any way. Not physically, anyway. Liliana tried to speak to get his attention. "Mm," she mumbled. "Mm." Manuel looked at her. His face lit up.
You're alive!
He glanced around the nest, checking to see if any Abuchwa were around. Then he crawled over to her.
Can you move?
Was all Liliana managed to say. Manuel peered over the edge of the nest.
We need to get down before they come back.
They? Liliana thought. There was more than one? She wished she could ask Manuel what he meant, how many there were, but her mouth was not cooperating. Her tongue felt thick and numb in her mouth.
I think I can climb.
No!
Liliana grunted. Tried to scrunch her eyebrows to convey her disapproval. There was no way he could climb down the tree without falling. There were no branches for the last 30 feet before the ground. He would need to descend the sheer vertical trunk with nothing but his bare hands. It was impossible.
What then?
His chin quivered, his eyes brimmed with tears.
We end up like them?
He gestured to the collapsed sacks of empty skin scattered around the nest.
I don't want to die like that. I'm going to go home. I want to see Mama. I want Alma.
Alma was the name of the stray dog the family had adopted when Manuel was just an infant. It had wandered into their village one night while they were asleep, finding its way into their house through a gap in the wall. The family woke to find the dog curled protectively around Manuel's sleeping form, one paw resting on the boy's chest as it snored in time with his breathing. Their father wanted to get rid of the dog to send it back into the jungle where it came from. He barely had enough food to feed the family, let alone a snaggletooth mongrel with a broken tail. But when he saw how attached Manuel had become to his new friend, he relented. Alma was allowed to stay. Liliana wondered what Alma would do if she were in the Abuchwa's nest with him. She pictured the dog's wiry black hair standing on end, its lips drawing back to expose its crooked yellow fangs, its brow drawing low over its cloudy gray eyes, a deep growl rumbling in its chest to warn off the Abuchwa. Alma wouldn't let anything bad happen to them. She would protect them. She would save them. As if on cue, a resonant growl vibrated the floor of the nest under Liliana's body. For a moment, she believed she had summoned Alma, as if the dog had somehow been magically transported into the nest. She felt an unexpected surge of hope. Everything's going to be okay. Then Manuel began to weep.
They're back, he whispered.
He retreated into the corner of the nest where he'd been sitting before, pressed his back against the tree trunk, and hid his face in his hands. The nest swayed as something heavy climbed into it from below. An odor like decomposing flesh wafted over Liliana's face. Her stomach convulsed at the smell, causing a jet of hot bile to stream into her mouth. She swallowed the acid back down, grimacing at the sharp sting in her throat and the sour taste in her mouth. It wasn't Alma. And it was a buhuku. As Liliana watched in horror, the creature crawled past her toward Manuel. It wasn't the same buhuku that attacked her. She was sure of it. This one was female. It was smaller and less muscular than the first, with a half-dozen elongated, pendulous breasts dangling from its abdomen. Beads of yellow-white milk seeped from its nipples and dripped onto the floor of the nest. Liliana tried to move, tried to scream, tried to do anything to distract the creature from approaching her brother, but her efforts were futile. As the female drew close to Manuel, it made a cooing noise. It seemed gentle, affectionate, almost maternal. The Abuhuku reached out one of its long, multi-jointed fingers and touched the gash in Manuel's forehead. Manuel jerked away and sobbed into his hands. His entire body began shaking with fear. The Abuhuku cooed again, then scooped a drop of milk from its breast with its finger and wiped it across the cut. Surprisingly, the gash began to close. The skin was healing. The Abuhuku sat on its haunches in front of Manuel, wrapped its arms around him and pulled him closer, like a mother hugging its young. Manuel tried to twist away, but the thing was far too strong. With one enormous hand, it drew Manuel's head back so that his face was out of his hands. His eyes were squeezed shut. Mucus ran from his nose and over his quivering lips. He moaned in fear. The Abuchaku forced Manuel's face against one of its breasts. He tried to resist, but he was unable to break away from the creature's powerful grasp. The Abuchaku pressed its fingertips against the hinges of Manuel's jaws, forcing it open against his will, then inserted its thumb-sized nipple into his mouth. His body tensed, then relaxed. His mouth pulsed involuntarily as he began suckling on the Abuchaku's breast like a newborn. The creature cooed again and lovingly stroked the boy's cheek with its finger. The female Abuchaku turned its head and stared in Liliana's direction. At first, Liliana assumed it was looking at her. "I'm next," she thought. But then she heard a low-pitched snarl behind her. A powerful pair of arms lifted her from the ground. As her head flopped back on her limp neck, she found herself staring into the soulless eyes of the male Abuchaku. Her reflection was distorted in its glassy black orbs, but she could still recognize the look of abject terror on her face. The male Abuchaku wrapped its fingers around the sides of her skulls, held her head steady, then pressed its proboscis against her scalp. She felt a distinct pop as the blade-like appendage pierced her skull. A searing pain raced through her body like liquid fire, radiating down from her head into her torso and out through her extremities. She wailed in agony, expelling every ounce of air from her lungs. Drawing another breath was impossible. Her oxygen-starved brain began to shut down. Her vision blurred. Her heart seized. Her breathing stopped. As Liliana lost consciousness, the last thing she saw was Manuel nursing contentedly on the female Abuchaku's breast. His eyelids fluttered open. He looked directly at her. There was no flash of recognition, no hint of concern, just a small, satisfied smile as he watched her life slip away. I hope you enjoyed No Bones, Just Skin by Warren Benedetto, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Warren-Benedetto. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/WARREN-BENEDETTO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. While you might have to dig around in the deepest, darkest recesses of dangerous places, like the rainforest, the ocean, or even New Jersey, looking for strange creatures, sometimes you don't have to go far at all. Some lurk in the recesses of suburbia, perhaps digging around in your trash cans at 2 a.m. and can be very surprising when you're just expecting a raccoon or two. But even worse is when you're somebody, like part of the mail delivery service, and you already have to deal with enough problems. Dominic Eagle presents us with just such an unlucky fellow who's about to run into something he definitely is not expecting. Without further ado, I present to you The Postman. I've been delivering mail for 15 years, and it's mostly an uneventful job. I might glimpse the occasional nude person, pet a dutiful dog, or overhear a conversation worthy of a soap opera. It's not a job of thrills, and that's exactly why I've always loved it. It's peaceful, tranquil, a still, silent world in those pre-work hours before people spill out of their homes for the morning commute. Nothing ever happens. Until last winter, I saw something. A horror that I'm still struggling to put into words.
Nobody believes my story, and why would they? I scarcely believe my story, and I know it to be true. So if you find yourself doubting the truth of my tale, I don't blame you. But just know that no matter what you think, these things truly happened, even though I wish that were not so. Let me start from the beginning. I'm no nosy Parker, but some things are hard to ignore. The family at one particular house on my circuit was the prime example of that. Most days I'd have letters or an Amazon parcel to deliver to them, and it was always the same story. Father in the lounge, kids quivering on the sofa, and obscenities being yelled. Sometimes the mother, black-eyed and bruised, would be crying in the doorway between the lounge and the kitchen. I'd only glanced through the living room window for a second, but that glimpse told me everything. Every time I delivered mail to that house, I'd hurry up and down the front path as quickly as possible. I didn't want to be caught up in the middle of that horror scene. Unfortunately, one fateful day, that was exactly what happened. In the blackened twilight hour of a wintry postal round, I saw something in that family's house. Something for which no human words exist. For the thing itself doesn't exist. I know that. My logical, pragmatic mind knows that. And yet, I cannot deny what I saw with my own eyes. As I walked up that dreaded path, stomach in a knot, I found myself looking at an empty living room. Odd. It was the same delivery hour as usual. I wanted to just deliver the mail and be on my way, but something wasn't sitting right. My instincts were going haywire. I strolled across the front lawn to peer through the lounge window, and that was when I saw something horrible. In the kitchen, the mother's body was sprawled across the tiles. Only her legs were in view. The rest of her body disappeared around the corner of the doorframe. Blood stained the tiled floor, and her legs seemed still. I'd never felt so afraid, and I don't know how long I was transfixed by the sick scene. My brain couldn't fathom the gravity of the situation. Nothing about it felt real. And yet, I'd only scraped the very tip of the iceberg. Eventually, with two shaky hands, I summoned the courage to pull my phone out of my pocket. It slid around in my sweaty palms as I clumsily dialed 999 with one hand and held the device steady with the other. After stating the emergency service I required, I was immediately patched through to someone, but the wait felt endless. And once the police's voice emerged from my receiver, I immediately started to gush about what little I knew. I was promised that responding officers would be there in 10 minutes, and I thanked them. This would be the longest 10 minutes of my life. When I got off the phone and looked back up, the body had vanished. The pool of blood remained, but the legs of the mother had slid out of sight. My body started to convulse in terror as I wondered whether I'd been spotted by the unseen assailant. I wanted to flee with every fiber of my being, but I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if I'd done so. I thought about that poor family. The snippets of horror I'd witnessed over many months that finally slotted together like the pieces of a terrible jigsaw. A jigsaw I should have uncovered long ago. Perhaps I could have prevented everything that happened if I'd only intervened sooner. But I had my chance for redemption, and I wasn't planning on squandering it. I didn't want to live with the prospect of being a coward for the rest of my life. 10 minutes until the police arrived. The father could be long gone by then. I had to wait. Not that I was much use, but I waited nonetheless. So, be of use, I thought to myself. It was the most foolish thing I'd ever done, but I decided I had to act. Was it impulsiveness or guilt at the thought of my previous inaction? Hard to say. Perhaps the adrenaline of the situation had frazzled my better judgment. Whatever the true reason for my moment of madness, I dropped my mailbag on the lawn and took purposeful strides to the gate around the side of the house. Summoning every ounce of breath in my lungs, I inhaled deeply, puffing up my chest into something that I believed was intimidating.
I'm sure in my luminous jacket and scruffy trousers I must have been the farthest thing from intimidating, but it didn't matter how I looked. My toughness would have no bearing on the situation. I had no idea what I was about to endure. I opened the gate and tentatively crept down the side alley. The garden, from what I could see, was overgrown and unkempt. From the front, the property looked shabby but relatively put together. The rear of the property was telling another story entirely. It was neglected, near apocalyptic, a wasteland. I know those homes well. I know the whole town well. And that street was built 2 decades ago. Yet it looked as if the lawn had remained untouched since the day the family moved into the house. Everything about that place was a warning sign. My limbs were working against me, legs buckling as I walked towards the side door. My brain was telling me to run. My body was telling me to run. Everything was telling me to run. And yet I plodded onwards, propelled by some inexplicable urge to prove myself or offer reparations to the family for my previous dismissal of their situation. The side door was coated in scratches, deep crevices that were clearly carved by some sort of animal. But I couldn't say what kind of animal. Certainly not a dog, a cat, or even a wild creature. There are foxes and rodents in this county, but none of them could have left indents so severe. I could have been forgiven for not turning around before that point, but placing my hand on the door handle was an act of utter stupidity. Bravery. Perhaps a combination of both. The door was locked. Given how forlorn and forgotten everything appeared, I had half expected it to be ajar. My heart was pummeling my ribcage at this point, but I had no idea whether the children were safe or not. I had to act before it was too late. So, with the sole of my shoe, I started to boot the side door. I used all of my might. It took a few attempts, but the wood snapped around the latch. I managed to wriggle the handle and clumsily push the door open, splintering the wood as I did so. "Hello?" I called. No answer, no sound. The door led to the utility room, a cramped space filled with messy piles of clothing. Bloody clothing. Or rags, I should say. Every garment was tattered and torn, barely recognizable as attire. But I hadn't turned around at the sight of any other red flags, so what could possibly have prompted me to leave at that point? And so I pressed onward, of course. Opening the door at the other end of the utility room, I finally had a clear view of the kitchen. I could see the horrifying spectacle in all its ghastly glory. The mother was still alive, though barely, and she was crawling through a puddle of her own blood toward her husband. He was lying in the farthest corners of the kitchen, clutching his blood-stained work shirt. There were dozens of puncture marks littering his shirt, and I saw the culprit, a stainless steel kitchen knife in the mother's hand. She used her left hand to pull herself across the towels while brandishing the sharp instrument in the air with her right hand. The father could only watch in horror as his wife slowly crawled towards him, contending with her own assortment of various terrible wounds. There were far deeper punctures in her skin, though. I couldn't see the weapon the father had used to create them. I took shaky steps into the kitchen, unsure of what I should or could do. Atop the kitchen counter, most horrifying of all 3 tiny children huddled together. None of them looked physically wounded, but they were certainly emotionally scarred. I'm a fully grown adult, after all, and I know I'll never scrub that memory from my mind. The police will be here any second, I feebly shouted from the kitchen doorway. The words escaped my mouth before I even realized I'd uttered them. I clasped a hand across my lips, and the father twisted his pale face toward me. The life was draining from his glazed-over eyes, but they still bored deeply into my soul. Haunting black eyes had terrorized his family for so many years. There was something deeply wrong with him, beyond the obvious. This was more than a human abuser. I could feel it. not just in his stare, but in the very atmosphere of the place. Those four walls felt like a cage, an ever-shrinking cage. The mother didn't even turn to face me after I announced my presence. She just kept crawling toward her husband, committed to her cause. So I locked my gaze on the children. Their frightened little eyes were swimming with tears. I motioned for them to carefully clamber down from the counter and come toward me. The eldest shook his head, but I pointed to the corner of the kitchen that was far from the horror of his parents' battle. I was indicating that it was safe. After a few minutes of deliberation, the eldest boy convinced his two younger sisters to slide across the counter and drop to the kitchen floor. They crept around the growing pool of blood on the floor, crying at the sight of their dying parents.
"Mommy,"
the youngest girl bawled, but her brother firmly gripped her hand and gingerly led her away from the spectacle. When they finally reached me, I ushered them out the back of the house. As the last of the three children disappeared into the side alley, I felt a weight lift from my chest. It felt safe, though I was far from it. And then I turned to face the parents again. I wish I hadn't. The mother reached the father and she began to repeatedly plunge the knife into the near still body of her abuser. He lifted a trembling hand to her neck, but he was too weak to properly grip her. And she was too weak to do anything but plunge the knife into his flesh over and over again, a repetitive motion, expending the very last of her life. I imagine she dreamt of doing that for years. And though I couldn't see her face, I knew she was in survival mode. She hadn't responded to words from me or her children. She just beelined for the monster that had been torturing her and her children for so long. I'm not sure whether her final act lasted a second or a minute, but eventually I was the last breathing thing in that kitchen. Both parents lay still on the holy red kitchen tiles. The mother had collapsed on top of the father, knife still in hand. It was a horror that I still struggle to put into words. And it would have been sufficiently terrifying if that had been the end of the horror. "Mrs. Clarkson?" I asked, timidly walking over to her corpse. She didn't respond. I knew she was dead, but I hadn't fully accepted that. Not yet. And I found my gaze drifting to the father, Mr. Clarkson. Though he was a monster, I couldn't bring myself to leave that room. If he were alive, I would have felt guilt for the rest of my life. It wasn't my place to strip children of their father, no matter how dreadful he may have been. "Mr. Clarkson," I asked in a hoarse whisper, praying he wouldn't answer. I was praying he wouldn't utter a word, and he didn't. But he stirred. My body clenched as I saw it, a slight twitch in his left hand. The first movement from either of their bodies since Mrs. Clarkson's horrendous attack had ceased minutes earlier. There's no way he could have survived, I thought to myself in horror, squatting down. Absolutely no way. I inched closer on bent knees, flitting my gaze between his left hand and his eyelids. I dreaded seeing those black pupils again. I listened for anything. The sound of a heartbeat, breath escaping his lungs, but there was nothing. And so I kept my eyes firmly fixed on his face, hoping that the police would arrive without a moment's notice, hoping, above all else, that his own eyes would stay shut. And then there came a crunch. My eyes shot down to his hand, and I screamed. His flesh had given way to a bulky, hairy fist, a clunky, oversized appendage that had cracked the towel beneath it, and I trembled in terror as his clothes began to tear. Slowly but surely, starting from that left hand, his limbs began to enlarge and sprout hairs through the newly formed rips in his attire. I stumbled backwards, crawling across the kitchen tiles. I could only watch in silent disbelief as the man before me began to transform, body growing to fill the kitchen corner. I should have run for the side door, but my brain turned to mush. I spun around and darted through the living room, and when I turned at the doorway to the front hallway, I saw something horrible in the kitchen. Those black eyes. Mr. Clarkson was awake, and his transformation was complete. He lunged forward at a pace unimaginably fast. In the second it took me to slam the living room door closed, the man-wolf creature, the dogman, had covered half the distance to me, and as I stumbled backward in the hallway, his gargantuan form came crashing through the wood of the door. His body was ensnarled in splintered pieces of wood, and his claws were mere inches from my face. I turned to the front door, ready to make my exit, but my stomach dropped. The front door was boarded from top to bottom. I didn't have the strength or the tools to remove the wooden planks, and so I made another foolish play. I began to dart up the stairs, ignoring the sounds of the creature, wrenching itself free from its wooden prison behind me. By the time I reached the upstairs landing, the beast had already pulled the living room door to pieces, and it was eyeing me from the downstairs hallway, huge canines bared in a terrifying snarl. I sprinted across the landing, hearing heavy paws pound up the staircase, sounding as if they might fall through the floor. I prayed for that, but no such luck. I shut myself in the first room I found, a child's bedroom, and though my first instinct was to hide, my brain was starting to process the situation. I was gradually pushing myself into a corner. Soon there would be nowhere left to run, and I would be yet another in many meals for this fiendish being. I wasn't going to let that happen, and so in the midst of my dizzying surge of adrenaline, I frantically looked for a solution, attempting to tune out the sound of the wolf-like creature, tearing doors from their hinges in its search for me. There were only four or five rooms upstairs. It would only take a matter of seconds for the demonic thing to find me, and I knew that. I knew I had to act, even if it were to be the last thing I'd ever do. I faced the window and took a deep breath. No time to find the key. The beast would be upon me before I could open it. I scooped up a cricket ball from the boy's floor and hurled it at the glass pane, wincing as it burst through the center, forming a decent-sized hole with cracks spider-webbing outwards. I heard a mighty roar from the landing. Squeezing my eyes shut, I sprinted toward the window and prayed. As I hurled my body into it, the glass pane gave way and I plummeted to the ground below. I woke in a hospital bed. Dazed and confused, mostly confused that I'd survived, as had the children. I never stopped thinking about that moment, that cursed twilight hour. The kids were adopted by their godparents, as far as I know. They live somewhere far away from here now. Hopefully very far away. For the father, Mr. Clarkson, he was never found. I pray he cannot find them. I pray he cannot find anyone. But I know in my heart that he's still out there, wreaking acts of atrocity. I still call him the Dogman, but the truth is, I have no idea what I saw on that day. I hope you enjoyed The Postman by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, well, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DOMINIC-EAGLE. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Well, I guess perhaps it was something he should have expected. I mean, how many times has the post office had to deal with an unruly dog in their daily lives? In the northern parts of the earth, we're well into the gray doldrums and it's winter, after all the good holidays are over, except for that unpredictable of holidays, the snow day. For some of us, though, we can't call off when we wish. And so, Kyle Harrison, He brings us a tale of a school bus driver who's called into work on one of the worst of days possible. But oddly enough, the state of the roads is not the only thing to worry about. Without further ado, I present to you Bridge Ices Before Road. The forecast said we were going to have a hard freeze, and they weren't lying. The first sign of trouble in our neighborhood was loss of power. Around here, they don't really prepare well for ice on the trees, and one of the older magnolias in the area snapped and hit a power line. Our family huddled in the middle of the living room by the fireplace to stay warm that night, as temperatures steadily dropped. By morning, we'd found every blanket in the house to stay warm, and the power still wasn't on. I thought I had to make sure I had a fast charger for my phone because I was expecting a call from my job. I work as a school bus driver, and typically weather like this means that we'll get a snow day. The roads, they get slick, and it's far too dangerous to send the kids out. However, the one making these decisions, our school superintendent, has a bad habit of making last-minute decisions. It was in September, not long back, when we had our tornado go through some neighborhoods, and he expected us to be able to go down there and get kids and get them to school on time. Not exactly something you can do with debris and tree trucks and workers blocking the road. It's about 4 a.m. when I got a text from my supervisor announcing that school would still be open that day since the majority of the routes were in town. Only a few out-of-town routes would be exempt. I cursed as soon as I saw the message and called her back. There's no way I can make it. The power's been out all night and I have to cross a long bridge just to get into town, I told her. They told me they had no one to cover my route because other drivers couldn't make it. If I didn't at least try to drive in, my job could be at risk. I started to get dressed and my wife berated me. I don't have a choice. There's no one to cover my route. She glared at me. We're talking about your life. The roads are too bad. Plus, you have to cross that bridge. You know how dangerous that can be. If I don't, I don't want to risk losing my job over something like this. I told my boss I'd have to drive slow. I'll be safe, I promised her. She had every right to be angry. It was still below 20 degrees as I stepped out of the house and warmed the car. I used a small cup to clear ice off the windshield and checked the time, 5:20. My route normally pulled out by 6:10, and it normally took me about 20 minutes to make it to work. Only to leave early, I thought. I thought if I took every precaution in the book, I'd be safe. Cautiously, I backed away from our driveway, and my wife was furious. She'd threatened to sue the school if something happened to me. I just wanted to get the day over with. I could tell that it was going to be a long, dangerous drive just as soon as I made it out of the neighborhood. Slick spots all around. The roads near our house weren't actually very bad, if I'm being honest. Thankfully, there aren't many trees that had a lot of shade in this area. But as I left the area and got on my way, I soon encountered some slick spots. And then, not to mention, there was the debris. I was searching for an excuse to turn back. I could only send my boss the picture of an impassable route and then get back to my warm bed. This wasn't the first time I had to drive in these conditions, so I knew how to react when I felt the tires sliding on the ice. I just kept on going slow and steady until at last I reached the bridge. The bridge that we were worried about runs across about a mile of water. There was no nearby way around, and from what I could see, it would save me time, but it didn't look like anyone else had traveled on it all night. There weren't any barricades either, though, so it made me wonder if that meant it was safe. It wasn't daylight, and snow was still falling. I could see the glistening ice in front of me and tried to coordinate a plan to cross. If I went slow, stayed in the middle, I should have been able to get across, I told myself. It wasn't a safe plan, nor was I confident that luck would be on my side. My car was a four-wheel drive, and I'd gone across slick spots already.
I could make it. Something in my gut, though, told me I was wrong. My heart pounded as I started forward. Looking toward the water, I told myself the worst-case scenario was that if I get stuck and simply not be able to go to work, in some ways it would benefit me. I'm not sure how many different things I told myself to convince myself that I should do it, but I did. I pushed the ignition down gently, and the car went forward. Gently and firmly, I was crossing the bridge. After about a minute, I was sure I'd be okay. There was no need to panic, I told myself. I could feel the ice and the car shifting a bit, but so far, I'd managed to make sure I didn't lose control. Less than a few seconds later, that was exactly what happened. The ice was thicker near this part of the bridge, and I knew it. I tried to move forward, but I couldn't. My tires were simply spinning end over end. I tried to switch to reverse, hoping that would keep me from going any further. Then suddenly, the car was sliding toward the edge of the bridge near the railing. I have to admit, despite all my years of training, I panicked. I instinctively jerked the steering wheel, which only made the whole situation worse. My car did a full swing and spun out of control, slamming into guardrail hard. My airbag deployed, my windshield cracked, and I felt my front left tire go off the bridge. Before I could make another reaction, my car was dangling on the side of the bridge, and I found myself staring at the icy water. I could see my life flashing before my eyes as I looked down at the cold, flowing water. Desperately, I tried to see if I could put the car in reverse, but nothing I did helped. Instead, it tilted more toward the water, and I knew I'd need to act fast before I wound up at the bottom of the lake. I was just about to unlatch my seatbelt when I heard a strange noise from the side of the bridge. I paused and glanced to the passenger window to see something moving up about 50 yards down the road where the railing had split due to my impact. The snow made it difficult to see at first, but it looked to be about the size of a house. It lurched forward, its body hitting the road, making a growling noise as I realized this was a living thing. I saw its sharp blue eyes, and they gazed straight toward my car. I found myself paralyzed with fear, watching as the thing stood up. It was huge, and it looked to be made of stone and ice. Its body had all sorts of moss and glistening rock jutting from it as it lumbered toward me. The hand of the beast was large enough to encompass my entire vehicle, and I watched as it grabbed the car on both sides. I couldn't even let out a scream as my car was abruptly held up by the monster, my windshield cracking apart and the metallic frame crunching as it moved me into the air. Its massive blue eyes gazed into my car, looking straight at me the way a predator would its prey. Then it set my car down near the middle of the road, perhaps for easier access to attack me. I remained completely still, watching as the creature slowly settled back against the railing, its breathing ragged and angry as it looked toward my vehicle. What was it thinking of doing to me? For the moment, I couldn't think of doing anything except watching as it stared at me. Perhaps its vision was blurred by the snow and ice and couldn't determine what I was. Then I heard something from the other end of the bridge and realized another car had attempted to cross. This one spun out of control a lot faster than I did and smashed into the middle railing. As its alarm went off from the crash, the giant beast was alerted and started toward the vehicle. I watched from my seat as the troll immediately ripped the passenger door off the vehicle, looking inside to grab the driver. I heard a woman scream and watched as the monster dangled her from the side of the vehicle. Her arms flayed, and she tried to fight against the beast as it looked at her curiously, the way a dog might a new chew toy. Then it bit her head clean off. I watched with an open mouth as I felt the cold air hit me like a strong stone. The crunch of the bones and the blood that trickled from the beast's mouth told me that it was enjoying the tasty treat of human flesh it had just found. There was no doubt in my mind I'd be next if I didn't act quickly. I unbuckled and climbed into the back seat
as the troll tore apart the other vehicle, tossing parts of it aside like they were mere pieces of paper. I lay down on my belly and tried to be as still as possible. If the monster didn't know I was here, maybe it would forget about me entirely. I waited for what felt like forever as I heard the troll finish the body off. Then it lumbered again toward my vehicle, and I felt the car rock back and forth. My heart beat faster and faster as it tried to see if I was inside. I heard a low roar. Then the front door came off. I had my keys in my pocket, and I had only one chance to distract the beast, so I took it and set off the alarm. As soon as it sounded, the beast balked backward on the ice and actually fell on its bottom, growling angrily. I took the chance to climb out of the car and crawl under it as the alarm kept going off. My body lay right against the ice as the troll stood back up, bellowing angrily as it struck my car like a football, flipping it up and revealing my hiding spot. I couldn't afford to hesitate, pushing myself up and dashing across the ice. I didn't get very far. My face smacked against the cold ground, my feet hardly able to stand. But I kept going, clawing my way up and crawling toward the other smashed vehicle. The giant cryptid let out a loud bellow, pursuing me with malice, but soon had the same problem as me. Its massive body fell onto the icy bridge, the stony claws of the monster just barely grazing my leg. A trickle of blood seeped out in the harsh cold wind. Well, it felt like fire against my skin, but I couldn't stop. My life depended on getting away from this beast. I scrambled and moved to the other side of the bridge, hardly able to breathe as I searched for a way to hide and defend myself. The ice troll was back up, carefully pushing its body toward me, snarling as it tried to attack. I held my hands over my face, fully expecting to be clawed to death. My wife and family would never even know what had happened to me. They would assume I'd died in a car wreck on the way to work. I was cursing my job as the beast got closer. Then, to my surprise, I heard a noise from the far end of the bridge where I had first tried to cross. I dared to open my eyes and saw what looked like a diesel engine truck nearing the edge of the bridge. There was a trucker sticking his head out to wave at the troll, attracting its attention. He kept slamming his horn down and taunting the beast, making the monster even more enraged. Was he insane? The troll turned from me and started toward the truck like a lumbering ape, eager to slash the diesel into a million tiny pieces. As the troll got closer, I saw the trucker climb into his cab and rev his engine. He had to be crazy, but I was unable to stop looking away as he slammed down on the ignition and pushed his 18-wheeler straight toward the icy cryptid. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion. He kept holding down his horn to ensure the troll didn't move. His truck somehow managed to get enough momentum to not be hindered by the ice. Then the two obstacles collided. His diesel truck smashed into the chest of the troll, pushing it back toward the guardrail. Snow fell harder as I crawled toward the new pile of debris. As the truck skidded out of control on the ice, I watched the troll get cut down, unable to stop the vehicle as it fell to the edge of the bridge. I searched for the trucker, spotting him crawling out of his window, then jumping to the lake below. The temperature was well below freezing. I made it to the guardrail on the other side of the monster, searching the water for my rescuer. I spotted him, desperately looking for shore, and I knew I had to act. I jumped into the water just as I heard the troll let out another guttural scream, bashing the 18-wheeler away like a toy. As I hit the water, my body became racked with pain. I swam through the ice toward the trucker, grabbing him and pushing us both to shore. Behind us, I heard a loud lurching noise and realized that the entire stone bridge was starting to collapse. The ice troll stood up, about to chuck the metallic trailer from the 18-wheeler, and then the bridge started to crumble underneath his feet. The two sides caved in, pushing the stony monster into the freezing water just as we made it to shore. I was shivering, hardly able to regulate my own body temperature, as I desperately tried to save the trucker. His face was turning blue and it looked like he was having an asthma attack. I stood up and looked toward the road, knowing our only chance might be to flag down a passing car. I laid him next to a rock and ran to the road. The highway looked so empty, except for the tracks from my vehicle and the two unfortunate motorists that had come this way. My heart sank as I realized that rescue might be very unlikely given the weather conditions. I looked back toward the trucker. His body was still and I panicked. Had I already lost him? A horn blared from the road and I whipped my hands back and forth to an oncoming truck. He slowed down, peering out at me as I struggled to talk. Please, there's been a bad accident. This man's going to die of hypothermia. The other driver got out, rushed to the shore as I looked down toward the bridge. There was no evidence the monstrous troll had survived, but there was also nothing to say such a beast had ever been there. The driver that stopped came back to me, urging me inside. What about him? I shouted. Too late. The cold got to him. You'll be next if we don't get you somewhere warm, he told me. I complied with his orders, sitting inside the warm cabin of his truck as we carefully drove along a different road that went the long way around the lake. What were you thinking trying to cross that bridge in this weather? The talker berated me, but I said nothing. I kept thinking about the blood on my hands. Two other people are dead now because of me. An hour later, I was at the hospital and receiving treatment that I needed for all my injuries. I called my wife and told her about the bridge accident. I didn't mention the troll. I didn't tell anyone because I knew no one would believe me. I also called my job and told them I was quitting. All of this risk could have been avoided had they not sent me out in the first place, I thought as I settled down in the hospital bed. Well, there isn't much more to the story. It's not like there's a moral here. I can't really say I was expecting this sort of encounter with a legendary monster, but it's changed me. I don't cross any bridge now unless I'm sure I can make it all the way, and when I'm driving across, I listen for any noises from below. I feel certain one day I won't be as lucky, and I'll meet those stony creatures again. But until then, I tell everyone to drive safe and stay off the icy bridges. The ice hides many dangers, and many of them are not for the faint of heart. I hope you enjoyed Bridge Isis Before Road by Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KYLE-HARRISON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. How many troll puns would you like me to tell you now? Watch out for the troll bridge? Pay the troll toll? Not the kind of troll that should start a flame war on the internet. Okay, I'll stop now. Especially since we should mourn him now that he's been put on ice. Oops. We bring an end to the evening on two lovers, both clearly devoted to each other, or so it seems at first. Seems that one side of the marriage isn't being forthcoming with the other, and suspicions are running rampant. But sometimes it's best to leave well enough alone, as Brian Martinez is about to reveal. Without further ado, I present to you Girls' Night. My wife, Rebecca, once a month, she has these nights out with friends. There's six of them, girls she's known since college. They go out for drinks or whatever chick flick is playing, and she comes home well past midnight, tired and smelling of sweat. The next morning when I ask her how her night went, she always says the same thing. It was fun. Our life together is comfortable. Rebecca's good to me, and I try to be good to her. And yet, there's always this tension simmering just beneath the surface. It took me a while to realize it was those monthly girls' night gnawing away at me. Rebecca and her friends get together for what's supposed to be an innocent night of fun, but something about them leaves me on edge. The signs are small enough that you'd miss them if you weren't looking. Late-night phone calls, punctuated with whispers, tight-eyed glances when she thinks I'm not looking. You can only hear so many conversations stop when you enter the room before you think it's more than simple gossip. I try to dismiss my concerns as paranoia, nothing more, but my suspicions grow more with each month, blackening like a tumor until it's all I can think about most days. It can't be ignored any longer. I think my wife is having an affair. I fell in love with Rebecca because she was a butcher. The neighborhood where I lived in my 20s was famous for having a Greek meat market that people traveled miles to visit. They had lukaniku, sausages flavored with garlic and orange peel, an enormous variety of souvlaki and moussaka, and above all, lamb chops to die for. One day, when I was in the mood for some pork rib, I visited the market, walking its cramped aisles packed top to bottom with oregano and pita bread and bechamel sauce. Dozens of cuts of meat hung over the counter, adorned with paper signs handwritten in blue marker. Between two raw steaks, I spotted the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. She was a goddess in a white coat, spattered with galaxies of red. I forgot all about the pork rib and asked her about whatever's closest to her face. "Excuse me," I said, "do you have anything that still has the heart?" "Not after I'm done with him," she replied. I smiled, and she smiled back. I paid for my purchase and left, but my thoughts stayed there all day, like a tether connecting me to her. So I went back at closing time, and with my stomach in my throat, I'd asked her if she'd like a coffee. "And what took you so long?" she asked. Our time dating is a whirlwind. Rebecca is the wildest, most exciting person I've ever met. I'm insanely in love with her, and by the time our one-year anniversary rolls around, I'm already shopping for engagement rings. And yet, through our smiling days and sweating nights, there are her friends, women I meet a handful of times, and enjoy their company. Except once a month when I'm left at home, watching TV and waiting for Rebecca to get home. It's all right with me at first. I think it's great that she has close friends. But then the whispers start, the vague summaries of movies, and it starts to feel like the beginning of the end. After another hushed phone call, I can't contain my thoughts any longer. They're like rats inside my skull, chewing and scratching to get out. So that night during dinner, I decided to confront Rebecca. "What did you and Melissa talk about?" I ask, and she looks up casually from her pepper steak. Yeah, the usual. Her boyfriend's a bum. She hates her boss. She goes on like this, conversations I've heard a dozen times before, until I can't stand the lies any longer. "So what were you two whispering about?" I asked. She looks like I just stepped on her foot. "What do you mean?" "You do that a lot, you know. You whisper. Like she's shooting for an Oscar." She says, "Do I?" "You know you do. Was that Melissa on the phone?" "Of course it was," she laughs, putting down her fork. "Why would I make that up?" "You tell me. Why would someone do something like that?" Her face tightens into a scowl that tells me she's finally taking it seriously. "It was Melissa," she says. "You can check my phone, but first, you should really think about what that says about you. Now it's a test for me. Now I'm the one in trial. There's no winning this now. Even if I'm right, I get the angry, jealous fiancé you see in every chick flick she's supposedly watched." "It was really Melissa?" I ask. She smiles and puts her hand on mine like I'm a child being led across a busy street. "You have nothing to worry about," she says. "You're safe." And what I want to say is you haven't answered my question. What I want to say is that even if you had, it wouldn't prove anything. But I can see that the direct route is a dead end, and I don't feel like screaming. So I force a smile, my best smile, and get back to chewing cold meat. The next girl's night, she kisses me and tells me on her way out the door not to wait up. I smile and say I won't, then count 2 minutes on the wall clock before I grab my car keys and head out. In my car, I bring up the app on my phone and pray the magic tracker is held. Sure enough, the green dot comes up on the map heading east. I'm distantly aware that I shouldn't be doing this, that it's a betrayal of our trust. But all I can focus on is hunting down that little green dot, following it to where it stops. I trail her through the moonlit streets of our town, far enough back that not even a dog could see me, all thanks to the small metal box stuck to the chassis on her car. I don't like that I have to do this, but I can't go on, month after month, not knowing where the woman I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life with is going at night. I tried to ask her. I gave her the honest way out, and she didn't take it. If she'd just told me the truth, we could have dealt with it and gone on with our lives, possibly separately, but at least from a place of honesty. She did this, not me. Eventually, on the outskirts of town, the green dot makes a few smaller turns and stops just off the road. I slow down, careful not to give myself away, and 2 minutes later, I'm confused to see a secluded farmhouse in the distance. Rebecca's car isn't visible from the street, but judging by the tracker, she parked around back. The way you do if, say, you wanted to hide it from passing traffic? The farmhouse is from the 40s, maybe earlier, and hasn't seen a hammer or a can of paint since. The roof sags with water damage, and the long driveway has been taken over by weeds and crabgrass. No lights are on inside the house, and I can swear I can even see a few broken windows. If anyone still lives inside there, they must be the boogeyman to the local kids. I don't know what I'd expected to find by following Rebecca, but I know this definitely wasn't it. With my car parked down the road a bit, I slunk across a long expanse of lawn, long gone to seed, my unblinking eyes trained on the house and the surrounding area. Insects scream and trees blow in the wind like hands trying to wave me off. Everything in me says, turn around, but I push through knowing it's too late to turn back. If I don't find out what's going on in this crumbling farmhouse right now, I'll live my life with it embedded in my brain, a splinter that pushes deeper into the skin the more you try to pull it out. I reach the house, feeling nothing but stillness coming from inside. A dark silence shared only by condemned and abandoned places. So I sneak along the side and around back, where I find not just Rebecca's car parked in the house shadows, but two others. I don't recognize them. Their hoods are warm to the touch. The cars are clean and new and utterly out of place, behind a crumbling farmhouse occupied by rats and maybe the occasional junkie passing through. Stranger still, the house's back door is boarded up, meaning I don't know where Rebecca or any of them could have gone off to, leaving their cars behind like this. That is, until I spot the old barn set a distance away from the house, a dim light glowing between its uneven slats. My heart pumps so loudly I feel it in my throat. I choose each step carefully, not making a sound, as I cross the open ground between the crumbling house and the ruined barn. Faint voices drift from inside, but I can't make out who they belong to or what they're saying, only detecting an excitement to their tone, an edge of arousal that worries me deeply. Again, I am tempted to turn back, but the image of Rebecca's smile across the dinner table, lying right to my face, makes my cheeks flush and my fingers tighten. The barn doesn't have any windows I can look through, so I have no choice but to go inside. The problem is, the only way I can find, other than the main door, would give me away instantly, is a side door that's locked from the inside. I find no comfort in this. Whatever Rebecca is up to out here in the middle of the farm that time forgot, It's taking place behind locked doors. This, the locked door, is all the motivation I need to locate the loosest board I can find and pull it loose. It hardly makes any noise at all. The dried, rotten wood coming free like a woman shedding her pantyhose. Slipping through, I immediately hear several voices, Rebecca among them. Their excitement is even more palpable now. The sound of my footsteps through the darkened animal stalls is hidden by a woman's laughter. A woman who doesn't sound like Melissa, but maybe one of the others. Maybe Diane or Vicky. Whoever they are, whatever they're up to, it's not what Rebecca told me they'd be doing tonight. When I emerge from the stalls, my heart drops at the sight of several people with half their clothes off, lit by an electric lantern on the floor, undoing belt buckles and lining up their shoes neatly, removing hair ties and wristwatches, hanging blouses on hooks nailed into the wall. My mind spinning, I register each of the faces one at a time. Vicky, Melissa, and so on, until I see Rebecca. Only her shoes are off, but she doesn't seem to be stopping. Before I'm forced to see one more item come off, one more moment of betrayal, I step out from the shadows. "What is this?" I ask, and they all turn. "Tori," Rebecca says, her eyes wide open, trying awkwardly to hide her feet. She looks from me to her equally horrified friends and back. How did you? The six of them are all women, Rebecca and her friends. Girls' night, after all, except nothing like I pictured, nothing like I'd been told. Then, with a slight shift of motion, I noticed, just beyond them, a seventh occupant in the lantern-lit barn. A goat stands tied to a post, chewing on a pile of dead grass. It regards me with one wide, rectangular pupil in the shape of a minus sign. "What are you doing in here?" I press on. "What kind of sick stuff is this?" "He has to leave," Vicky says in an adamant tone, and Rebecca puts out a hand to quiet her. "Tori, you can't be here," Rebecca tells me, her voice even and restrained. "The hell I can't. I asked you a question." My skin grows hot, beads of sweat dotting my brow. I don't just feel lied to. I feel as if I no longer know who Rebecca really is. Maybe I never did. As Rebecca pleads with me to leave, saying she'll tell me everything later, that in time I'll understand, the light streaming in from the outside grows noticeably brighter. "Get him out of here now," Melissa says forcefully, moving forward as if to grab me. Her eyes are wild, as if responding to her. The goat lets out a nervous cry. "Please, just go. I'll explain everything later," Rebecca pleads, her eyes wet, lips on the verge of a tremble. But I stand my ground. "Explain it to me now, or I'm not leaving," I reply. "You don't understand. You..." Her words cut out as she doubles over, clutching her stomach as if in terrible pain. The goat lets out a shrill cry as the rest of the women, all of them at once, grab themselves and writhe. Some lean over, others bend sideways at odd, painful angles. Confused, embarrassed, I watch as the six women tear off the rest of the clothes quickly as they can. It's as if the very material burns their skin. The six of them, naked and hunched over in the dirt, screaming with faces twisted into masks of pain. I stand frozen in the musty barn, staring at Rebecca as her once familiar face contorts into something unrecognizable. But not just Rebecca, but all of them. I watch as they moan and cry, watch as their skin and bones shift and crack, their naked skin growing thick hair. Ears elongate and rise. Noses turn leathery and flare. Either the night air goes cold around me, or the blood drains from my face and limbs, but my lips tremble and my teeth chatter. How long the change takes, I can't say, only that I'm shouting at myself to run before it's finished. But my legs do nothing, and soon the transformation is complete. The women, all six of them, are no longer human. Massive creatures now occupy the space where they stood, covered head to toe in fur of different shades. Some are dark brown, some ashen gray. Rebecca is all black, the fur standing on end like the bristles of a rush on the sink. Her eyes glow like firelit amber. Long claws extend from her fingertips, razor sharp. Her teeth, daggers. They drip with thick saliva as she notices the goat tied up across the room. Her throat emitting a guttural, hungry growl. All six of the impossible beasts focus on the goat, their backs hunched as they move toward it, with sinewy muscles rippling beneath fur, and I pray like I haven't since I was a boy that their attention stays on it, that they don't take notice me backing away slowly, quietly, my legs shaking under a flood of adrenaline. My foot hits something solid. My mind screams that it's one of those things that snuck up behind me with its clawed hand, its paw, pulled me down to the dirt. And yet somehow it's worse. The electric lantern tips over under the force of my kick, falling onto its side. It's not the loudest sound in the barn, not by far, but it's enough to be picked up by the six sets of large ears sharing the barn with me. Inches away from descending on the poor, defenseless goat, the creature is stopped. My fiancée's head, rather the head of what used to be my fiancée, snaps toward me, her eyes like yellow fire. I stumble backward, tripping over the fallen lantern, before regaining my footing. Judging by the trembling of their tongues, dilating of their massive pupils, the creatures have forgotten all about the tied-up animal and turn their attention on more engaging prey. I look around to see if there are any weapons close by, a sturdy shovel or a nice sharp pitchfork, but it seems those have all been removed. Briefly, I consider whether an electric lantern could do any damage, but I give up that idea when I take the sheer size of the six masses. Moving toward me are long clawed feet. So I do exactly what you're not supposed to do when faced with a wild animal bent on attacking. Turn my back on him and I run. Pushed forward by the excited roars behind me, I backtrack through the barn, feet slipping on old hay as I push and stumble, and race back to where I entered, going so fast I slam into the back wall with my shoulder. My nerves light up with pain and my vision flashes, but I don't slow down for a second, not with the vicious snarls at my back. I don't know how I do it, but I drop to my knees and shove myself through the space between the wall boards before they can grab me, landing in the dirt on the other side with a hard thud and a clutter of limbs. As I get to my feet and run across the field, the sound of shattering wood fills the night air. It sounds as if they're tearing the barn to pieces, scratching and pulling and thrashing to get out. With the cold night air burning in my lungs, I run like hell in the direction of my car. It doesn't take long before I hear them, massive footsteps galloping across the field, coming up behind me. I don't dare look back, fearing the sight of those monstrous creatures on my tail. The rhythmic pounding of their paws echoes in my ears, growing louder with each moment, and I stumble, catching myself on the edge of a clearing. And as I turn, I see them, the beasts stampeding toward me, their eyes fixed, tongues lolling, eyes burning. And then the one in front, the lead, it jumps. I only have a second or two to contemplate the monster screaming through the air at me, and yet each second feels like a year, 10 years, a lifetime of happy moments bookended by decades of poor choices and disappointments. How much I would have done differently, I think, especially tonight as it lands on me. Massive weight takes me to the ground, hot breath pressing me down. My eyes take in the full moon in the sky as the teeth sink into my neck, my belly, my chest. There's no fighting it. I'm at the center of a flurry of fangs and claws, six monsters tearing and biting and ripping me apart. And yet I know, even now I know, who's the first to eat. The way she knows where to cut. The way she goes right for the heart. My Rebecca, a butcher to the end. I hope you enjoyed Girls Night by Brian Martinez, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And more than that, a thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, 10 years ago. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky. And get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?